That is correct. Wow. Tonight, a gentleman that I really enjoyed, not much older than I am, which tells you he must be pretty old, considering I'm old. But let me say this about him. This is a man who has never given up on the game of football. And for those of you that have followed this program, you know how important to me football is. And as it is part of the fabric of the Canadian lifestyle that many people don't realize. And one thing we've established here, we've had a couple of dozen CIS players that were vying for the draft, of which I think we interviewed at the end of the day, we had about 8 or 10 of them that were drafted on the show. What you learned from these people, these young men, is that not only are they men of character, they're also men who love the game and to whom each time money really isn't central to why they want to march through a tunnel onto a field with those bright lights shining, wearing those beautiful CFL jerseys to the wailing crowd waiting for them. That's what it's all about. It's about the game. And in the game, I always talk about how wonderful these guys are. And for those of you that do listen, you know I say it. For those of you that know me, know I mean it. And this is one of the, well, one of the biggest proponents of the game of football, very close to where I live. And he doesn't know me, but I'm sure about this. We all know who he is. And for those of you that don't know him, once you hear his voice, you'll know exactly who he is. He is no stranger to the microphone as well. Played football for the Toronto Argonauts, number 77 on your program. The biggest question I'm going to ask, don't ask me any tough questions, Frank. So I'm going to start with the toughest question of all. First, let's bring him on. And ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Peter Martin, husband of Wendy. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Frank. How are you? Hey, with all those, that introduction, man, I want to go back to the gym and get ready to play again. Hey, coming out of the tunnel and the uniform and all that stuff. Good
stuff.
Well,
you know what? You know what? I know you believe that in your heart, and it's something that you've never lost the love of the game, have you?
Well, thing is, you mentioned, too, we didn't play for money, so coming out of the tunnel and the big crowd, that was your biggest reward. I'd do it all over again in a minute if I had a chance to do it. No question.
Now, absolutely. And for those of you that may not be aware, Peter did wear number 77. What years did you play? I got it here.
I played with the Argos from 1965 to 72.
There you
had
go.
Had a tryout with the Ottawa Rough Riders. I was drafted out of Western by Ottawa in 64. Went to their training camp and got cut. Came back to Toronto, played senior football with the old East York Argos. Some of the old people might remember that one. And then I got a tryout with the Argos in 65, and I was fortunate enough to hang around for 8 years.
You know, you have a giant history in the game of football. We'll get into a lot of questions, but I'd like to really get a cut across section of who Pete Martin is. Pete Martin, you know, you went through the normal standard way of making the Canadian Football League, that is through university in Canada. Then you played the CFL, but you didn't end your love or your contribution to the CFL. You spent many a year on the radio talking about the Toronto Argonauts. I remember, I'm only a few years younger than you are, but I'll tell you, in the day that you were doing the football, when we were up north, let's say at a cottage, or we would listen to the Argonauts play on the weekend on the radio. If you couldn't make it to the game, it was a big deal on the radio. Tell us about those days.
Well, yeah, that was a lot of fun, and I kind of fell into that in a way. I retired beginning of the 73 season, and I was an Argo season ticket holder and went all to the games. And I started doing the radio in 1977, and Dave Hodge was doing the games then. And in 76, his broadcast partner was Mel Proffitt. Now, you'll remember Mel. He was a teammate of mine with the Argos in the late 60s and the early 70s. And Mel got a little bit too critical, I think, of the Argos, and they didn't particularly like some of the things he said. I understand that one of his comments was that you could put the Argo offense on the head of a pin. Now, that didn't sit too well with the powers to be, so they were looking for another commentator. And so they had some auditions, and they were looking for someone, who had played for the Argos, and hopefully somebody who lived in Toronto so they wouldn't have the expense of bringing them in and out. So I took the audition, and I ended up getting the job. And what started out as a year-to-year thing ended up, I lost track, like 26, 27 years. And, of course, my last year was 2010. And over those years, I worked on three or four different radio stations with seven or eight different play-by-play guys. So I was really lucky that I had such a long career like that on radio, and it certainly was a lot of fun.
Now, we established that you played less than 10 years in the CFL, almost 30 years broadcasting, but you spent most of your life working locally. I'm in Mississauga, actually. The show's done through Mississauga.
Yep.
And you've got a deep involvement in minor football, and I've tried to promote minor football in Canada the only way I can, which is basically talk to the young players that that are involved. And you really do the sense of the type of young lads that play the game of football. I find that most of them are very humble, and also they're major team-oriented.
Yeah, well, there's no question about that. And, I've always thought that, you know, football is the one game that you know, you need that to play the game, because really, you know, you can't do it by yourself. I mean, when you've got 24 different positions, 12 players on the field, and the positions and the responsibilities are so interrelated, you know, that you have to, you know, you have to be a team player. I mean, because you just can't put yourself first when you're playing football. And that's what makes it such a wonderful game. And, you know, I had, you know, like I started playing football in high school at Winston Churchill in Scarborough, and, you know, went on to the University of Western Ontario. And my main ambition in life, I wanted to be a teacher. When I went to Western, I was taking the phys ed degree to be a high school teacher, and was lucky enough, you know, that I made the Argos in 65, and I was able to do both, Frank, and that was the one thing that was wonderful, is that I could, you know, teach school and play football at the same time. So I got started in the education system, and then when I retired, I got into coaching at the high school level and coached at Port Credit for just a bunch of years and had some success there. And then you mentioned, too, at that time, I lived in Mississauga. I moved out to Mississauga in 1965, and people who don't know what Mississauga looked like back then, there really wasn't much to it. I mean, there were more farm fields than there were houses back then, and a growing community. And I got involved with a group of guys, and we're sitting around having a beer one night, and I just had a son. A son was been born, and they said, you know, what are you going to do when your son's old enough to play football? We don't have a football league in Mississauga. And I said, well, why don't we do something about it? So within 6 months, we had the Mississauga Football League going, and that was in 1971. And it's still running today, and has produced a lot of fine football players that have gone on to the CIS and several players that have played in the Canadian Football League. So, you know, when you talk about my involvement in football, it goes back to, I guess, when I first put on the uniform when I was 14 years of age.
Yeah, it didn't take as long to put the jerseys on there because they had no sleeves at that time when you were playing.
Well, you know what they had at Western? Now, you wouldn't believe this. Like, you're not as old as I am. I know that for a fact because you told me how old I am. And I'm going to give away my age because I may sound like it tonight, too, and after a while, that I played with a leather helmet, if you can believe that, right?
Listen, I've talked to you for a while, so it didn't have a bad effect on you.
I did. I played with a leather helmet at University of Western Ontario, where Johnny Metrich was the coach. This was in 1960. I was 175 pounds, and I was a guard. I was an offensive guard at 175 pounds, 180 pounds. And they gave me a leather helmet. And I hit the blocking sled, and I missed the sled and hit it with my head. And I had spent the night in the hospital with maybe my first of many concussions, I guess. And so after that, they gave me a Riddell helmet, which at that time was really, you know, the best helmet around. So I finally got a regular helmet in 1960 or 61. So but the jerseys we had then, if you're going to believe this, they tied through your crotch. Did you ever see one of those? Right.
Yes, sir.
There was a flap that came down the back, and there's a flap at the front, and they had buttons, right? So you know, it was buttoned in your crotch. And but the thing was, if somebody grabbed your jersey and pulled a little hard, it hurt a little bit in different places. But that's the type of jerseys we had back then, and make sure that they didn't come out of your pants, I guess. That was the reason they did that.
You know, you talk about the old days of football. For playing back then, what would be really one of the biggest things that people today would not believe or understand, other than the uniforms, about the way the game was played?
Well, You know, we still played with 12 guys, you know, and the field was a little longer. The end zones were 25 yards deep, right? They're only 20
That's
now.
That's right.
Right? And they made, you know why they made that change?
Exhibition Stadium?
No, it was BC Place Stadium, I think.
Ah,
you know,
okay.
They had some stadiums that they couldn't get the 20-yard end zone in, so they changed it to 20 yards. You know, the game, you know, you still play with 12 guys, you run, you block, you know, you do all that sort of stuff. But the big difference is the size of the guys. That's one thing, right? And the way you run, the way you pass has changed dramatically, too. But the size of the players is incredible. I mean, in 1965, I've got a program here from 1965, and the heaviest guy we had on our team weighed 278 pounds. Now, and he was probably be considered obese at that time. Like, he was really overweight, right? And so our guards were 220, 230, all right? We weren't very big, and nobody was big back then. I mean, the players now have just grown to be such size, it's incredible. And to me, that's the major thing. And the other thing, too, was that people wouldn't believe is that how many games we played in a short period of time. We didn't start the season until the middle of August. We'd go to training camp 1st of July, play four exhibition games, and we'd start the season in August because we only played a 14-game schedule. So we had to cram the 14 games into the season, and the Grey Cup was still in November when it is now, the last week of November. So we would go on these famous Western swings where you'd have to play Friday, Sunday, Saturday, Monday, right? You'd fly to Vancouver, play there, say, Friday night, jump on a plane, fly to Edmonton, play there Sunday, right? And then we come home, excuse me, and then we'd have to play again at home on Saturday. So we'd play three games in 8 days, which today would be unheard of. I mean, they would never, you know, think of doing that now. So because of the nature of the game, I guess, the size and the speed and so on, and that allowed us to do that. And that's, you know, that's a major change. Now, I mean, you know, the players, you know, they have a difficult time if they don't get a full week now between games.
Yeah, you know, people are surprised that, you know, TSN is involved with football and guys like you and I that have a memory. We remember when, you know, CFTO, I think it started in, what, 64 or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And the Bassetts and CTV became a big deal, and them and the CBC used to split the Grey Cup because they couldn't agree on which year they'd get. So the best way to make sure they both were involved, they'd switch. One would get the first half and the other would do the second half. And television, the biggest difference, I guess, people don't understand, back in the day, it was the Argos, and then the Leafs would have two games a week. And on Saturday, the game wouldn't even start on television until after it was almost to the end of the first period.
End of the first period,
Yeah, you know. And
I remember
that. Yeah, and there wasn't the television sports. What was it like being an athlete, really, in Toronto, not as recognizable as now? I mean, they know when a guy develops a gall darn pimple. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Back in the day, you guys ran a little bit, you know, under the radar, if you will, and because people that really didn't see your image as much as they do today.
Yeah.
How difficult as a broadcaster, you watched, because you've been involved so long, how drastic a change and how quickly did it happen where all of a sudden these guys were under the microscope like they are today?
Well, you're right. Television did it, right? I mean, it put a face onto the players, and it put names on the back of the jerseys, right? And so you were now, you know, known and so on. But, you know, the amount of notoriety of a player in Toronto, I think, might be a little overblown, I think. And that, you know, I could walk around. Like, I was well-known when I played. I was well-known at Port Credit Secondary School because all the kids at the school knew I played, right, and within the community. But I could walk down Yonge Street, and I'd go anywhere, and no one knew who the heck I was, right? I could go shopping with my wife, and no one knew who I was, right? And that was through most of my career, and I enjoyed that. I mean, that was perfect, okay? And that, you know, you weren't – I was never had the status of a – you know, a Joe Theismann or anything like that anyway, and the best of times in my career. But so I think a lot of the players could walk around and nobody would know who the heck they are. And I think that probably still applies today. I mean, I would think that in Toronto, most of the Argo guys can walk around town and nobody, other than maybe Pinball, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ricky Ray, maybe, okay? But I hang out with Bill Simons all the time, right? And he's Hall of Famer and all this sort of stuff. We go around all over the place and people know who he is. So I think this notoriety thing and being recognized and all that stuff from a CFL point of view in Toronto, I don't think that's ever been an issue with the players, that they've been swamped by people that they couldn't go shopping because people are, that you're under the microscope all the time. I don't think that's been I don't think that's the way it's been in Toronto with football players anyway.
Yeah, I saw him. He was on the field. I'm trying to remember. Was it after the Grey Cup? Was it after the Grey Cup? He was there. He was, I think, about on our side, near our section. And I went to walk over to him and say, "Hello, Mr. Simons." And I turned around and said, "Nah, it can't be him."
Yeah.
So
he's
I did
big.
recognize, you know what I mean?
You didn't recognize. He's a little bigger. Yeah. He could play guard right now.
Oh, yeah. He's still a big guy.
Yeah,
he looks pretty good because he's got to be middle 70s, early 70s?
Oh, no, he's younger than I am. I mean, Billy would be 70. Yeah, he'd be 70,
yeah.
I guess. But Billy was one of the guys. Like, you were talking earlier about, you know, how the game has changed and all that a little bit. You know, maybe it's hard for me to explain it. You know, we made reasonable money. And I guess based on cost of living and how prices have gone up and so on, I probably made as much in 65 as the Canadian kids are making now, okay? Now, the people have to realize that when I played, that they paid more money in the CFL than they paid in the NFL, right?
Right.
They did. I mean, it was the CFL could go down and entice players to come up here. Right, they won the bidding war with Joe Theismann. I mean, the Argos gave Joe Theismann more money than he was going to make in the National Football League. And when he left Toronto, the Argos were offering him more money than he was going to get in the NFL. But he wanted to play down there. So money really wasn't the whole deal. And one thing, when the American guys came up here, because, you know, I mentioned the fact, you know, we didn't start till July. And we practiced at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, right? So you could have a job, right? Like, I taught school for the 8 years I played. I taught school, went to school every day, went to practice at 5 o'clock. If you came up here as an American and you got to be known as a player, a football player, it did open a lot of doors for you job-wise. So a lot of guys were able to come up here and play football and work. And that's what Cy did. Guys like Dick Shadow and Bill Simons and guys like that, they came up here. Marv Luster taught school. Dick Aldridge taught school. I taught school. Bill Simons got into he was working for Admiral Corporation. They used to make television sets. So they had a chance to work. And a lot of the guys stayed here. As a result, when their careers were over, they had established themselves in the community. And they said, hey, this isn't a bad place to live. So they stayed here. So there's not as much of that going on now, right? Because it's really hard for the players now because they practice at noon, right? And the whole day is shot. They can't work during the season. So sometimes it's difficult for them to get established. And a lot of the guys go back home when their careers are over and don't stay in Toronto.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned, I don't know whether it's because he was an Ottawa player, but you didn't mention Russ Jackson. He was a principal.
That's right. Russ taught school. Yeah. Oh, don't mention Russ Jackson. Did you watch see that thing on TSN? They did the thing when the Leafs blew that 3-goal lead, right, to Boston.
Okay.
And the TSN did a thing that was the top 10 disappointments for Toronto sports fans. Right?
Yeah. I think I saw part of that, yes.
It was really good, right? And, you know, they had the Blue Jays and they had the Leafs. And the Argos, teams that I played on with the Argos, we made two of them, right? We were 2 out of 10, right? And you might be able to guess one of them, right? And that was Leon McQuaid's fumble in 71 Grey Cup. And the other one was involved Russ Jackson. Now, remember in 68 or 69, the Eastern Final, both years we played the Ottawa Rough Riders in the Eastern Final. And back then, the Eastern Final was a two-game total point season,
That's
series.
That's right. Oh, my goodness.
So,
yes.
Yeah, and you'd play sudden death in the playoff. We beat Hamilton both years, I think, and anyway, or Montreal, what? So we had to play Ottawa back-to-back. So we played the first game at Toronto both years, and then we had to go to Ottawa the second, play the second game. Well, I guess it was 69, whatever. We play Ottawa in here, and we beat them by a couple touchdowns. Leo Cahill made the famous comment, right? Only an act of God can keep us out of the playoffs.
Oh, right? God.
So yeah, we go to Ottawa. That is horrible day. I mean, it had snowed all week, and the ground was sort of semi-frozen, and there was mud and everything. Anyway, we lost. I don't even know what the score was. We just got kicked all around the ballpark by Russ and the boys and everything. And I guess the headline next in Ottawa was, God walked across the Rideau, right, in the form of Russ Jackson or something
absolutely,
like that.
Absolutely. But what a great player he was.
And I've often thought, you know, if you go back and you research offensive football teams in 68-69, I think that the offensive unit that the Ottawa Rough Riders had might very well be the best ever assembled in the Canadian Football League. They had Russ Jackson, they had Whit Tucker, Ronnie Stewart, Bo Scott, Vic Washington, right? And it goes on. Joe Poirier, Ronnie Stewart, I mentioned him. Like, they just had an incredible teams. And, you know, the number of guys off those teams that are in the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, you know, three of those guys, Atkins and Bo Scott, Vic Washington, they went back and played in the National Football League for a while. So, I mean, they were an amazing team. So, you know, I'm making an excuse for ourselves here, but we got whacked by a pretty good team.
Well, no, the Argonauts did, you know, they were the, and I apologize for this, but they were the lovable losers.
Lovable losers?
That's what they were, man. They were the lovable losers.
Now that we're on this, did you see the other thing that TSN did for the Grey Cup, the documentary on the 71 team that was entitled The Greatest Team That Never Won? Did you see that one?
Yes.
You talk about lovable losers.
It must be so heartwarming to know that you had such a wonderful career. So, hey, why don't I just kick you completely to the ground and say, what does it feel like not to have won a Grey Cup?
You know what? You remember Granny Liggins?
Oh, God, he was beautiful.
Okay. Well, Granny lives not far from me here, right, in Oakville. So I dropped in at his place today, right? Well, Granny, he played for Calgary in 71, right? So he's got a Grey Cup ring. And Granny's not a gracious guy when it comes to rubbing your nose in it, right? Like, you know, you go and he'll have his ring on and he'll just sort of wave it in front of your face, you know, one of those kind of guys. Like, so I've been put through that ringer enough, Frank, that it doesn't bother me anymore. Because we didn't deserve to win. We were terrible that day. Right? We didn't play very well. And we really didn't deserve to win it that day.
Yeah, but you know what, Peter? There's more, to playing in the CFL and more to life than actually winning a championship. I'm not here to sell anybody on the idea that winning is not great, but you know, there's more. You've done so much, I really am serious about this. You've given back. Mississauga has some great football leagues, as you mentioned, and they produce some pretty good football players. My neighbor, in fact, is a coach at. I think it's Port Credit. He's at Port Credit. He's a young kid, you know. He's, I think, an assistant coach. All these players, they really owe you and like guys like you a deep debt of gratitude for promoting the game. In America, more, I don't know, can you answer me this question? Because what I do notice in talking to many of the American players, ex-players, because you don't want to really get into this kind of stuff with players who are playing today because you don't want to get too deep in their personal lives, right? Mm-hmm. So what I do is with the ex-players, I'll talk to them about it. And they come from really, really, the word today kids would use is sketchy backgrounds where, you know, their lives were pretty close to, they were pretty much kicked into a sewer, if you know what I mean. And I don't mean to overemphasize it, but football has been a saving grace for at least a long time in my memory for American football players. You know, our friend that you mentioned, number 31 for the Argos, he says that football really doesn't love you. It's not something that loves you. But in fact, I think the opposite is true in the sense that before you arrive at the pros, it gives you something to live for and try for and feel that you can be, because these kids don't get the same opportunities in some of the places in the United States to get educated, to move forward in life. They're held back. I don't want to get into a giant political thing, but football tends to teach them, again, teamwork and being part of a bigger group.
Yeah, you're right. But it's Frank, it's not so much just the game of football. It's the athletic scholarship does it too, right? I mean, and football and basketball and there's a lot of stories like that in basketball too, right?
Kids
that come from sketchy backgrounds. So it's the opportunity that's provided by a kid that comes, you know, a ghetto kid or wherever he comes from, a family with no means. That if he's good and he gets some advice and gets some training and some coaching, the carrot is out there, right? He says, I can make something of myself. I can get a university education. I can maybe play professional, all right? So, and that's what the American system does. It gives these kids an opportunity to a move to the next level as a player, but also move up academically and improve their chances of employment and having a successful life afterwards, right? Now, here in Canada, it really wasn't like that, right? It gives you an opportunity to go to university, because if you were a good football player, all right, you can, you know, you get recruited and, you know, they'll say, hey, well, you got to keep your – and for me, for example, it was an incentive because, hey, my coach said, you know, you got a chance to play college football and all this sort of stuff, but you got to have marks to do that, right? If you want to go, you got to get marks. So the incentive was, hey, to try to do as well as you can academically so you can make that next step. But the issue was, once you got to that step, the hurdle was, how do you pay for it, right? Because there's no scholarships, or at that point in time, there were no scholarships here. There are now. I mean, CIS can give a certain amount of money to players now, but they couldn't back then. So football really is an incentive, right, for you to use football to try to get to that next step. And I think, but the scholarship program in the U.S., the benefits for the kids are a lot greater than they are in Canada, or the opportunities are a lot better for kids.
And of course, they're making inroads. Well, not inroads. There are people and there are forces that are hoping to make more inroads, where more of the money that the colleges, you know, it's the same situation. Actually, I'm probably overreaching, but we were talking earlier about how the CFL was competitive with the NFL as far as salary is concerned. It's not because they made the same amount of money. It's because even the salaries did not jump in the NFL until a short few years ago.
And it was all because of television.
Absolutely.
It's all because of television.
Absolutely.
It's all because of television. Yeah, and like we can get into this whole scholarship thing in college football, and I have a lot of thoughts about that, and a lot of them aren't positive thoughts, because, you know, the one thing.
Peter, let's save that after the break. I gotta do a favor for some people. I'm trying to sell the odd Argo ticket tonight.
Okay,
you know,
good.
So I'm figuring by the end of my show in a few months, I maybe will have sold about 10, 12 tickets. I'm really trying really hard. You know, I'm trying really hard to sell that.
Okay.
The following is a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
Do you want to be heard, disagreed with, or just plain shot down? Come on! Be brave! Call the Candid Frank Live Show, a.k.a. the CFL Show. You already hit the link to bring up the player, and you hit the play button so you can hear us. Now hit that little Skype button on that Candid Live player sitting there, like your pet wanting a snack. So to connect with us and tell us your thoughts, hit that little tiny, cute, and tempting Skype button. Right? Now, do it! Or call 714-242-5250. That's 714-242-5250.
Bill Pella of your Toronto Argonauts, and you're listening to Candid Frank Live.
You're listening to Candid Frank Live, streaming on Rouge Radio. We're the Argos cheerleaders.
Autumn is hunting season. The catch is gray. The contending captors are blue. The Winnipeg Blue Bombers. Rough, raw, and ready with the ultimate victory so close. They can taste it.
They were here to win.
They hungered for it. And match for match, they hunted down.
The play calling has been good by Tom.
The beauty and the beast. Designed for maximum audience participation.
I am Ryder Pride,
the flag bearers of our league.
The spirit of our game.
I will deafen all foes.
I will represent my team,
my province,
and my fellow fans
with honor and pride.
And inspire the next generation
of the Rider Nation.
Green is my color.
Football is my game.
This is my pledge.
This is my pledge.
This is my pledge.
Did I mention, Peter, that I'm an Argo fan. I have season tickets, but I'm an even bigger CFL fan. I've really grown to love the game. I've had the chance to reconnect with it. Pretty much the word out there is that the people that are carrying the league right now are people my age, maybe a little bit younger. They've lost their young connection, which is something hard to recover once you've lost it in this day and age. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, like there are pockets where that hasn't happened. Right? I mean, they have no problems in Saskatchewan, right? I mean, they've got the young people. When I say the young people, I mean, the guys and the kids, late teens, early 20s, the university kids, the college kids, the young professionals, they haven't lost that group there. And Winnipeg, I think, is sort of the same way. They sort of have lost that here in Toronto. And I guess it's hard to explain in that maybe it's the fact that, you know, for a while there was a decline in the number of high schools that were playing football, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I went to high school and when you went to school, I'm sure just about every high school in the city of Toronto and the greater Toronto area had a football team, right? That's not the case now, right? So you have young people that, you know, when I was at Port Credit, we had, you know, kids that come through the school. We had three teams. You had the opportunity to play. And, you know, when we played doubleheaders, they let the kids out early, and the band was on the sidelines. And the football doubleheaders on Friday were a big deal. So you sort of got into the football spirit as a young person, right? You got into the football spirit. Now, if you go to a high school now that doesn't have football, right, and you don't play the game yourself, you don't have that connection to the game at a very early age, right? Maybe you might play minor football and so on, but minor football is doing a good job of getting the kids involved, but not having a full high school program, I think, has hurt in that the student body themselves are not exposed to what it's like to go to a football game. Does that make any sense to you?
It totally makes sense, and so
I think that is an issue. And I think too, the ethnic diversity in the city of Toronto has had a factor too, in that, you know, our population has gone up, but football is strange to them, right? Football's not part of their culture, right? And so that you have to try to win those people over and convert them to being football fans, as opposed to, say, soccer fans or cricket fans or whatever they might be at this point in time. So there's a lot of issues. But it's, you know what, though? When I was playing, I don't think that football, the games, a lot of young kids went to the games. I don't recall that. I mean, I sat in the stands for 5 years or 6 years before I started doing radio, and the demographics was not young. When I mean young, elementary school kids and high school kids. It was old. It was I think, be honest with you, it was the people who were old enough to drink, right?
Uh-huh.
You know what? I hate to say this. You know what I'm saying? There's something about, I mean, the old days of football, right? You go to the game, you freeze your buns off, you put your fur coat on, you put your flask in your coat, right? I mean,
right,
there's something about going to a game and having a pint, going with the boys and having a pint, or having more than a pint, right? But that was, have you been to an NFL game lately? You been to Buffalo?
No, I haven't.
You
I
go
haven't
to Buffalo?
Been...
There are no kids in the game in Buffalo. They're all drinking age people, and they're all hammered.
Yeah.
So,
you know,
in a way, football is, like, college games in the States aren't like that because there's not as much alcohol in the stands. They don't serve alcohol in the stands. They tailgate before the games, but they don't
there
serve alcohol
go.
In the stadiums. But so to me, that's been sort of as part of the mystique of football. Get the boys together, go have a few pints, go to the game, go out and have a few pints after the game and have a good time. That is sort of what I think is kind of the football, you know, what a football outing is. And it was back when I was playing. I mean, and when I went to the games, people were, they were just having a wonderful time. Half of them were in the bag. When the time the game was over, they're in the bag, right?
Well, that's probably why people weren't worried how cold it was.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I don't think football, a professional football game, is not a place where you take kids. Like the 8, 9, 10-year-old kids. I don't think you take them. You may think take them to a Blue Jay game, may want to go to a Leaf game, but I don't think you take them to a pro football game. I wouldn't take my young kids to a game in Buffalo.
You know what?
I might take them to the Rogers Center. I would take them to the Rogers Center because it's a quieter crowd down there, but I wouldn't take them to an NFL game in Buffalo. I wouldn't expose them to that.
Easy. Stop talking about the Rogers Center having a quiet crowd because I'm one of those rowdy folks with a horn and stuff. We've had this discussion with this fan, with the Box J Boys. I don't know if you know who the Box J Boys are. They're the supporters
of
the Hamilton Packers.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
You know, and we've had this conversation, and I hate to agree with you only because this is what I have to say after we brought up that subject. You know, with the criminal treatment of people who drink, all right, mm-hmm. that has arisen, and I am not against it at all. Please don't send me cards and letters and threats and stuff. I understand about alcohol and driving is a bad idea. I don't believe mm-hmm. in it. And if you talk to my kids will tell you, I refuse to drink and drive. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my wife does driving and she doesn't drink. Mm-hmm. So there's always a sober as a judge person in our party, if you will. Mm-hmm. So yeah, mm-hmm. I don't believe in that. But you've hit the nail on the head, and it would be nice. It doesn't have to be about getting drunk and driving. It could be about the party. I remember when I used to go to the Argo games in the day in the grandstand. They had that giant bar. They called it what? The touchdown? What was it called? I don't remember now exactly. Yeah. But people used to go in there before the game, and like you said, they'd light themselves up, and they were ready to go to the game. And it was okay. There weren't that many fights in the stands. I don't remember that many fights in the stands. Mm-hmm. There were. Mm-hmm. But there weren't that many. But that's the kind of crowd you had going to the football game. It was people who – it was really the working stiff's opportunity to unwind. And it was one of the ways that they unwound, which was go to a football game. You know, it was a working class – your sport is a working class sport. I don't think anybody would deny that. So, you know,
I don't think you have to be a lunch bucket, you know, to be a football fan. I don't think you have to do that. But I think there is a social element to it that makes it attractive, all right? Like if you go to Buffalo and you look at the tailgating they have. I mean, acres and acres
Absolutely.
And acres of people tailgating. The social aspect. They get together every other week, they come down, they bring their buddies and they do all this stuff. Like when I was playing in the heyday, there would be busloads and busloads of people that would come in, and they would all meet somewhere. They would meet at a restaurant, and they would have lunch, right? If it was a Sunday afternoon game at 2, they'd meet there at 10:30 or 11 o'clock, right? They would have lunch, and the bar would have a promotion on. They'd come in, have lunch, pile them all on the bus, take them down to the game, put them on the bus, take them back, right? Mississauga Golf Club out here in Mississauga used to have three or four buses, every game, leaving the golf club to go down to the game, right? So that was sort of part. That was sort of the thing, kind of the social party. Let's get together, have a good time, and go to the game and have some fun. And that's that we've gotten away from that. That just doesn't happen anymore.
And with it not happening, the interest in the game seems to wane when it's really more than just the game that's waning.
Well, you know what? The problem here, and I'll be honest with you, the problem in Toronto is nothing to do with the CFL or the Argos. It's the attitude of the fans in Toronto. I mean, I really think that for some reason, and you know, people will say, okay, the problem is the stadium and that, you got to get over that. I mean, and there's nothing you can do about that at this point in time. The stadium is the stadium. You know, I don't go because, you know, I don't like the Rogers Center or whatever, and it's not a good venue for football. But the problem is here is that the Toronto people are snobs. All right, they're snobs in that they think that the Canadian Football League, because it's not NFL, because it's not Major League Baseball, it's not the National Hockey League, it's not the NBA, it's the CFL, that it's second rate. I'm convinced of that. Like, they, for some reason, they'd rather be a poolie for NFL and can't be bothered, you know, giving the CFL a look. So to me, they're not football fans, right? They're poolies, right? And if you were a football fan, you'd go to an Argo game because it's football and it's good football. But it's just this thing that there's a perception in a lot of people's mind that because it's a Canadian Football League and we don't have, you know, Tom Brady and we don't have all these guys, that it's second-rate football. And it's not second-rate football. It's different type of football, but it's great football. It's not second-rate because the game is different than the National Football League. And if you look at it that way, then there's no reason why you shouldn't go.
Unfortunately, in Toronto, it's sports viewership is linear. You know, it isn't. It doesn't span across, you know, horizontally. It goes linear. Everybody gravitates to the team that everybody else likes. You know, the Leafs are the team. They say this is not a sports town. It's a Leaf town, not even a hockey town. Well, I beg to differ. I think really. The Argos, unfortunately, whether one wants to admit it or not, don't get the kind of attention that the Blue Jays, the Leafs get because primarily, in my opinion, they're owned by big corporations that have a vested interest in maintaining their popularity and keeping their name out there. Whereas with the Argos, even during the season, in a sports cast, you'll be fortunate to see a one-minute piece on them. You might get a 30-second piece of blurb on that they actually played, you know. But still, the most important thing, I have to agree with you 100%, in my opinion, is people don't understand how good the game is because they don't give it a chance. And, you know, football, unfortunately, more than any other game, really the game itself, you really get a flavor for the game at the game. It's not an easy game to show on television. You know, Fox can do all it wants with 9 million cameras, 12,000, whatever. You know, the fancy pitchers on the field. That just tells you that the game on its own on television can't be shown the way it can in person because they're just trying to match what happens at the game. And at the game, there's a feeling when you watch a Saskatchewan game or a Winnipeg game. When I went to the Grey Cup this past year. Mm-hmm. I cannot believe how exciting it was because every seat was full. We were crammed in there. The game was exciting. And that community feeling that you're referring to, I think, in a long-distance kind of way, Peter, is there's this big community feeling where you're getting together, you're having fun with a bunch of people, and this is us being together. It doesn't matter whether it's 12,000, 50,000, or 100,000. As long as we know that we're there and everybody's there, we have a good time. Football fans have a good time.
Yeah, but you made a good point. And have you ever been to the Indianapolis 500?
No, I haven't. I've been to the Indy.
I've been a few times many years ago. Right when I went, the place was jam packed. I watched it yesterday. There was a lot of empty seats there. Right, a lot of empty seats at the Indianapolis 500. So the first perception I have is there's something wrong here. Right, is it not as popular as it was before? What's going on? They're not selling all the seats. Same thing applies to football and CFL football. A big stadium that's not full is a problem for you, right? You're trying to sell something on television, and television does a good job of trying to sell the game of football. You do a game from the Rogers, out of the Rogers Center, the Argos get 22,000, 23,000 people there, okay? In the Rogers Center, it's half empty, okay? So on television, you see all these empty seats, and people are going, How come nobody goes? Right? I mean, there's something wrong with it. I mean, nobody goes to the games. Look at all these empty seats. What you have to keep in mind, with 23,000 people, it looks like a sellout in Montreal. Like Montreal,
absolutely.
You watch Montreal Alouettes play. Holy Christ, look at this. The place is packed, right? There's 23,000 people there, but it's full, right? People are sitting there, and they're all jammed in together, and the place looks full, and everybody's having a good day. But they got the same number of people there as they have at the Rogers Center, but the difference is the Rogers Center seats 52,000. The
absolutely.
Same perception happens when you play in Edmonton. Edmonton seats 60,000 people. They get 35,000 people, which is a good crowd for CFL football. It's
absolutely.
Half full. It's half full. So it comes back to the, you know, the stadium thing, right? That they don't need 52,000 seats in the CFL. You don't need 52. They just built a brand new stadium in Winnipeg. It's going to seat 33. The new stadium in Hamilton's going to seat 25 or 26, right? Montreal seats 25. Okay, Saskatchewan's 30. Okay, so the economics, you don't have to have a 60,000-seat stadium, right? You're better off to have a small, intimate place where the people can all get together. They feel close. They're all jammed in together. That's when the party starts. That's when the party starts. And you can make money with 29 or 30,000 people, right? You don't need a big stadium. You can make money at that. Like you can ask
absolutely.
The CFL guys, what do you need in Hamilton to break even? They probably say, well, if we can average 25, 26,000 a game, we make money, right?
Absolutely.
So you don't need the big crowds, but you need to – you can't have a place where you've got all this space between people, right? You're sitting down at the Rogers Center, and you got to yell to see the person sitting next to you, right? If you're
absolutely.
Sitting right in tight, if you're sitting all in together, put those 23,000 people all together in Varsity Stadium, it'd be spectacular. It would be spectacular. The atmosphere would be there. And that's what you have to have. You have to have atmosphere. And you get atmosphere by having people sitting in a smaller venue, all jammed in together, where they're feeling the same experience.
You know, what we're referring to here really is supply and demand. And I've mentioned this to other people. The Boston Red Sox would have no problem building a stadium that seats as many as the New York Yankees does. But
yes.
they've chosen not to. They've chosen
mm-hmm.
not to. It was a choice. It was a choice they made.
That's
and
right.
for those that think that if you have less seats, you make less money, no, my friend, you don't. Because
no, you don't.
It's all about
no,
supply and demand. You can charge $5 a ticket. For those extra 20,000 seats that you have there, you might make $8, $10 a ticket if you're lucky. Well,
mm-hmm.
if they're not there, the other tickets become $10, $15, $20 more expensive than if the other
that's
seats – we're there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's simple economics, and it is supply and demand. And unfortunately, in the CFL, it doesn't look like there's a big demand for the tickets. And that is a subconscious reaction, or creates a subconscious reaction in the general public, who go, well, there's empty seats there. Why would I want to go
right.
there? Nobody
that's
seems
right.
to want to go there. That's always
that's
been what I've contended. And I was very disappointed, Peter, I have to tell you, when we got these games, you know, I was disappointed that Toronto didn't get – not instead of Hamilton, okay? Never
mm-hmm.
saying that. I'm not saying that. It's too bad they couldn't have thrown something in there for, you know, outdoor
mm-hmm.
games like football, not just for the Argos. You know,
mm-hmm.
a stadium like we just described, anywhere between 25 and 30, 33, 34,000
mm-hmm.
seats, you know, for venues, you know, and it would help the Argos a lot. And then the other thing, this is my other favorite thing, I love listening to reporters who talk about, well, you know, football's an outdoor game, they should be playing it outdoors, so what if it's snowing? And then you ask the guy, I said, where do you sit during the game? Well, I sit in the press box
yeah.
behind the glass and it's 70 degrees.
Yep.
You know, so it's
you know,
great for the that's great for the media to suggest that it should be an outdoor game. But again, yeah. I'm just putting stuff out there. Remember, people are biased by their comments. They make comments that they don't understand. The ordinary football fan would not mind sitting outside, but I'm not saying they have to. That's my
no. And people would go back to see any stadium at the drop of a hat. They'd go outdoors in a minute. I don't think that's a problem at all. You know, the big mystery for me, Frank, and you should do some research on this. I've never got an explanation, right? For the fact that you know the Rogers Center has been an issue for the Argos, and I think at the time the BMO Field appeared at the exhibition where the soccer team plays,
Right.
You'd have to go back and refresh my memory here, but I think at that point in time there was talk of the Argos doing something at Varsity in York Stadium, York University, and all this sort of stuff. Now, all of a sudden, this soccer field appears, right? And then it is 26,000, 26,000.
Both
and after it's all built, after it's built and everything, they say, well, geez, that'd be a great place for the Argos to play. And they say, well, it's too small. Like, how did that happen?
And it's too late. It's too late.
How did that happen? Well, I'd like to know how that happened.
Okay. I'll try.
Okay.
I'll try to explain it. And folks, I don't have a book in front of me with the exact history. But to make a long story short, there was a time when the BMO Field was being negotiated. The two buddies there that owned the Argos at the time, I forgot their names. I apologize.
David Cinnamon and Howard Sekulow.
Yeah, thank you. Two wonderful guys. These guys were, mm-hmm. It seems every time we turn around, the Argos always end up with good owners who are salvaging the team, for Toronto mm-hmm. and for the CFL, right? So, as you said, they were in negotiations to get involved with BMO Field. The Toronto Maple Leafs own the soccer team, and the soccer team, and they made a decision. They said, you know what, we can't have a football team share the stadium with us because it's going to be a grass field. And then what they did was, because the Argos were distracted for a short time, and I'm saying this only as a listener and a viewer of news and sports, they were distracted by the opportunity to go to York, and York was going to redo their stadium, and the Argos would be able to play there.
Mm-hmm.
During that moment of distraction, I believe, Peter, that's when the Argos took their eye off the ball at BMO, and then the Leafs had the MLSE had their full focus on BMO for soccer. They not only said they didn't want them, when they built the stadium, they built it so you couldn't put a Canadian Football League
exactly,
there. Not just that you can't, right? And that's
mm-hmm.
that's how I remember it. Now, I'm not saying that MLSE jobbed the Argos I am saying this is that it's a shame in a town like this that
mm-hmm.
you have only one owner of all the stadiums. There isn't Rogers owns every stadium in the or at least has
quite
a partnership
it, yeah.
with, you know what I mean? So
what's
you know
the, what's the field at BMO now? What's the field at BMO now?
I think right
it's
now
an, it's artificial, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is artificial now.
That's right.
And now they're talking. Yeah, you're right. That they changed it. Then after they got their way, they changed it to artificial turf. Now
it's
the irony
because they developed an artificial surface. There was a point in time when soccer wouldn't play on artificial because they didn't get the bounce they wanted. Now they've developed. Now the Premier League in Europe, they don't play on it, but over here now you can play on artificial surface. They've got surfaces now that give you the bounce they want, and there's no reason why you can't play on artificial surfaces. But anyway, that's another story.
I've heard some rumors, and I've had some people tell me that one of the places that might be a fit, because it's getting to the point where the Argos are not going to have a place to play. Literally,
well,
there's
rumors that the Blue Jays and what are going to put the grass field in the Rogers Center, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the negotiations aren't done yet for the next contract for the Argos to play at the Rogers Center, from what I'm not very good with this stuff, because I'll be honest with you, Peter, I really don't care about the politics of sport. It sort of sneaks in my mind because I'm trying to listen for the other stuff. But having said that, the rumor is a good place to be because of the this is the opposite of what stadiums have been accomplishing recently in North America. They put a stadium in a place where development is available to them, and they're able to create a whole world around that stadium. That generally is what people do now with stadiums. And people are giving up on multi-purpose stadiums as well. Single use is very popular now. The baseball teams, the football teams in the U.S., they're all going with single use stadiums, right? So now all of a sudden Lamport Stadium comes to mind. A historical area. I think the Argos used to practice there, didn't they, or something?
Yeah, but it's
back
not big enough.
Can they do something with it?
Not big enough. No, not big enough.
So we're gonna have to talk to Hazel. That's about it.
Yeah, we don't have any land left, right?
No, we have a little land left. We have a little land left right by the by the lake where the four tubes were standing.
Yeah. Yeah, they're gonna have to do something. But and the thing is, the clock is ticking. If the Rogers Center, if they're gonna put grass in 5 years, and the clock is ticking, and so the Argos are. That's they're in a bit of a bind right now, I would think.
in a horrible bind, and they've had an owner who'd prefer not to own the team, not because he thinks anything less of the Argos, but because his heart number one is in Hamilton, and his interest is in BC.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know what though, and it, people say, well, gee, you know, it's really it's unusual that you have an 8-team league and you have one person owns two teams, but that's an indictment. That's an indictment, not against David Brayley.
Absolutely
it's
not.
It's against the city of Toronto and the business community in the city of Toronto, because no one was prepared to step up. I mean, he's doing that because there was nobody else. I mean, I'm sure the CFL did their due diligence, and there's no way that Mark Cohan wanted David Brayley to own two teams. But if he's the only guy that steps up, then you have to take his offer. So, you know, there was nobody in Toronto, no corporate people in Toronto who were prepared to salvage the team. So they had to go with David Brayley. That's my take on it. I mean, if there had been somebody else, they would have been with that person in the drop of a hat. They'd like to avoid this Brayley Bowl, right? The potential of a Brayley Bowl. They don't want that. But they have no choice because there's nobody else that will step up.
How much of a chilling of effect do you think the fact that Rodgers has been, you know, obviously pursuing an NFL team, and that has maybe a bit of a chilling effect that that's doomsday for the Argonauts if a CFL team comes here. I'm not saying it will be. I'm not saying it won't. I don't have really I can't make a call on that one. That one's kind of iffy on my from my way of thinking. And I really don't think the NFL is even interested in coming here. It would create a political maelstrom in the United States, because if they brought a team, an NFL team, to Toronto, there's a lot of cities in the United States that figure they should get one first, starting with LA, and it doesn't end there.
Well, and you know, the big thing would be that, you know, well, when Ralph Wilson says, you know, when he dies, then the club's going to be sold, right? And that's going to leave Buffalo. My betting would be it's not getting out of the state of New York. That's not going to happen. I mean, there's whatever, you know, Buffalo is going to have football down there. And if there's any threat of the Bills leaving Buffalo, somebody will come up with a solution to keep that team there, right? And my gut feeling is I think the Buffalo Bills probably make money. They just don't make as much as some of the other NFL teams. But I would think that they probably make a few bucks or break even anyway, right? Because their crowds aren't all that bad, and with their television contract, they get a bunch of money. And you're talking about L.A. doesn't have a team and so on and so forth. So I don't think, right now, I don't think the NFL, I agree with you, I don't think the NFL's jumping backwards to get into Canada. And I think this Buffalo Bill experience here has been a disaster. But that's Rodgers' fault, because they thought that we were suckers. Right? That we would, they could, well, they did. Did they not think that we were all a bunch of suckers?
Absolutely.
When they could put a $600 price tag on a football game ticket, right? I mean, that's ridiculous. But they would think that we would be gullible enough to buy that, right? And the prices have come down, and now they can't. They paper the house every time they play here, they paper the house and all this sort of stuff. But they're digging their heels in, and they don't want to admit they've made a mistake, right? It's been a disaster.
You're right. You're right. It has been a disaster, and for Rodgers, it's been a disaster. And they've signed on for 5 more years, so they're in for more disaster. So
they want to keep their hat in the ring, right? They want to keep their hat in the ring in case there is a chance that something's going to happen. But what about Mexico City? I mean, they get 100,000 go to game in Mexico City, right?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, that could be if they're going to go outside, and they could go to London, England before they come to Toronto. Right?
Absolutely, and there's been talk of that.
Because they're playing over there every year in Wembley Stadium, right? So who knows? They could go to London, England. But they're still hopeful, I guess, it's going to happen here. But they can't do it, and then once again, the Rogers Center becomes a problem.
It's not big enough.
Not big enough. Anyway.
Yeah. So I think we've beaten that dead horse. I guess I'll allow you one more final comment. And I just want to add one thing, and that is that with the money that Rodgers has spent in promoting a league outside of Canada, and they try to claim that they're a Canadian corporation proud of Canada, and they're undermining the CFL. At the very least, I wish a politician would get up and say and do the right thing, which is would say to Rogers, listen, we appreciate the fact that you've got all this extra money to spend and send it to the NFL and throw it away. Well, we're going to tax you 25%, and that money is going to go towards the Argonauts. You know, it's like I'd like to see them get treated like a team in any league that plays not fair. You know, there's luxury taxes, and obviously this is a lot. They should be fined. They should be fined by the city of Toronto or Ontario or the federal government. And say, you know what, you're doing something that goes against the Canadian game. We need to punish you. You need some sense.
You're talking like they did back when they. Was it what league was it tried to come in there and they told them they couldn't come?
The Northern.
Toronto Northmen. They ended up becoming the Memphis Southmen.
That's right. And exactly. That was Zonka, Kick, and Warfield, right? Weren't they three guys that came up here?
Mm-hmm.
No, it just makes me, a little bile comes up in my throat when I think about the money that Rogers is throwing away, making the Argos' life even more difficult than it needs to be. To me, it doesn't seem fair. You know, it just doesn't, it doesn't pass the sniff test to me, you know, being a decent thing. And Rogers isn't being a good, you know, not only are they not, you know, supporting the team or buying the team or making an attempt to do that, they're making it more difficult for a Canadian team in a Canadian league to survive in Canada's biggest Canadian city. And to me, that's bad PR. Sadly, it says a lot towards why the Argo fans, there's not enough people who understand how good the Canadian Football League game is and don't understand how much in the way the odds, the odds are against them in being successful in this city. And I've been fortunate. Like I said, that's it for me as far as the NFL is concerned. I'll let you have one more kick at the can if you want to talk about that, and we'll move on to another segment of your life.
Yeah, well, the thing, you go back, and it's going to be hard for the Argos to make money in Toronto, and without their own stadium. They're one of the only – they're the only club in the league that are not the primary tenant in the building they play in, okay? And, you know, you talk about Rogers. To me, the only way they're going to make any money is if you own the building, right? You own the building. You get concessions and all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely.
So it makes a lot of sense. Right, it makes a lot of sense for Rogers to buy the team, right? Because they could use their office staff, duplicate their whatever Blue Jays and all
Absolutely.
Of this sort of stuff, the marketing and everything like that. They could probably make some money with the Argos, right? But that to me is the only. But they're obviously not interested. They to me would be the logical company to buy them, right? But you know what the kicker is, though, because TSN has the radio TV rights.
Yeah, and they're not Rogers. So, you know,
they're not Rogers. They're not. Yeah. So TSN's got the TSN has got the TV. So, which makes this Maple Leaf Gardens thing all the more unbelievable, right?
But you know
what? The two of them can get together with that one.
They can get together because they've done it historically. They got together with the Olympics. They got together in the Olympics. That was probably the foreground and the precursor to them getting together and buying MLSE. They knew they could work together and both profit and unleash the parts of their companies that could use this kind of infusion of interest, this platform thing that they've been developing, right? So, at the end of it all, all that matters is, can the team make money? I say yes. Without
no, you know, but the thing was, I've been told that it doesn't matter whether the team makes money or not. It's the money is it's television hours, right? If Rogers can't get anything out of it television wise, they don't want it, right?
Well,
like if they can't make money from the TV, then it's not a viable option.
Well, this year I get you. You have better connections than I do because all I do is sit outside and sift through the CFL garbage. So I really wouldn't know what's going on at the CFL office.
But they would want to have. They'd want it, Don. They'd want to have, like the Blue Jays, for example. I would don't know whether the Blue Jays make money or not as a standalone team. But the fact that the Rogers own the Blue Jays and they can put them on Sportsnet and they make the money on Sportsnet, right?
Absolutely. So, TV ratings aren't bad for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, but they can't do that with the Argos unless they cut a deal with TSN because TSN's got the
right.
CFL rights. So that they could not get that carryover. Rogers couldn't get the Argos or the CFL on on their television channel. So to them, it's not a deal.
The groundwork is there right now. Mm-hmm. For the first time in years, and as a radio guy, you know, while you were doing the football games on CFRB 1010, you know, the home of Gordon Sinclair, you were doing the games there. You know, you had CKFH at the time doing the Leaf games alone. You know, and that's the precursor, the priest. That became the Fan 590 because they wanted to get in a better spot on the dial. They became 590. TSN now has Chum, and both those stations do Leaf games. So there is evidence that they can split stuff up. And the whole thing would be is that if they decided to take on the Argos, because right now the Argos and the rest of the CFL teams for the first time, and I don't remember how long. They're not paying to broadcast their games. They're actually being paid to broadcast the games. And to me, that's a step in the right direction, Peter.
Well, their television apparently they've signed a new television contract. And they're making some money, substantial money now from television. They are.
Well, when
CFL
you consider, you know, the thing, like people like me who lived for a long time with nothing. You know, and who had less than nothing. When I have something, it's not just what I have; it's what I don't have to cover for. You know what I mean? So the Argos, only are they making money this year off the TV contract, they're not putting in money to the TV contract. There's a hidden. I'm not going to call it a profit, but there's hidden black there that they've got. So good for the Argos and good for the CFL. They're doing well. They've developed a good partnership between Cohan, TSN. I've said here many a time, I'm very proud of the job that TSN has done. They've done a wonderful job of creating, like you said, that moment in time like the CFL used to have. They've made Friday nights football night, Canadian football night. And that is the kind of stuff that has to happen for the CFL to be popular. Where whether you're in the plains of Saskatchewan or at the corner of Bloor and Dufferin, you know there's an Argo game on tonight. You know, that's what we used to have in my day when I was growing up. We always knew when the Argo game was on. And we made time to watch it, and we would watch it as a family. One thing, I know that you don't want to bring kids to games, but I do know for a fact that my grandmother probably wore that uniform you were talking about, those strapped to her crotch, while she watched the game with her leather helmet. So, you know, there was interest familiar-wise, back in the day. So, you know, I don't know if we'll ever get back to that. But ultimately,
there's one other while we're on this. We're talking about, you know, the ownership of the stadium and so on. Like the Argos really have a tough time schedule wise, right? Because they have to as I mentioned before, they're the only team in the league that is not the primary tenant, right? So they have difficulty. Like their schedule this year, they have one game in September, one home game in September, the Tuesday after Labor Day. That's the only time they play in September because of the unavailability of the Rogers Center. But the other thing, and I know that TSN has done a wonderful job for football, right, and the CFL and so on. But there's one problem with that, though, is that scheduling is always tricky. When is the best day to play? Like, when is the best night to play? Is it Thursday night, Friday night? Is it Saturday afternoon? Do we go against the NFL on Sunday afternoon? Scheduling dates are always tricky, right? The one thing that's a problem is that I think that the television, in a way, dictates the schedule. They want to have a doubleheader. They want to have a doubleheader Friday night. That means four teams have to play Friday night. One guy will say, I don't want to play Friday night because everybody's going to the cottage, right?
Right.
Or it's not a good night. Thursday night's a good night. Well, we don't have football Thursday night, right? So I want to play Saturday afternoon. Well, you know, we got something else going on Saturday afternoon. We want to play Sunday afternoon. Well, we got something else on Sunday afternoon. So it's wonderful what TSN has done, but I think in a way they are restrictive how the teams can schedule their home games, and they may not be playing their home games at the best possible times.
And TSN's only, let's be honest, TSN's only interested in the numbers that they can draw to watch the game that are sitting at home, or the new folks that go to cottages now and have, you know, Bell or any other satellite service,
I think it's perfect that's the one thing that the NFL's got, right? They've got consistency in their scheduling,
Absolutely.
They always play Sunday afternoon. Now they got a Sunday night game, they got a Monday night game, and even a Thursday night game. But there's consistency in their schedule. Sunday afternoon, turn on the dial in the fall. You're guaranteed you're going to see an NFL football. With eight teams, the CFL has a tough time with the consistency of the schedule. They're all over the map, right? There'll
yeah,
be a game
not,
Tuesday
you're
night.
You're 100% right.
There'll be a game Thursday night. There'll be a game Friday night. There'll be a game Saturdays. Very few on Sunday, and so on. So it's an issue. And scheduling is an issue, and it's complicated by availability of the venues. It's availability of television, what the demands of TV are, and so on. So it's really it's a complicated situation.
Yeah, a lot of people don't also understand who might be out there saying, well, you just finished saying that they should only play one day, but they're playing different days in the NFL. I want people to realize this, and I'm not trying to – Peter doesn't need my defense in any way. Please bear in mind that Thursdays became famous because of the turkey game, there's a tradition there. And what's happening is, and I think what your point, Peter, is, I want to make sure that the folks out there understand this. The CFL schedule is not something that is driven by the fans or by the game. It's driven by the television, whereas in the United States, the fans are driving. They want to see more games. So you do have to sort of spread them out a little bit because they want to be able to see, the largest majority of fans in the NFL are not rooting for their home team. They're rooting for the team they bet on.
But the thing is, in the NFL, from what I understand, the NFL has always played Sunday afternoons, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the television didn't tell them to – they've told them maybe you're going to move like the one game a week to Monday, right, and one game to Thursday. But primarily they've been a Sunday league from the get-go, right?
Absolutely.
Years ago, the CFL was a Saturday-Sunday game league, wasn't it?
Something
games
like that.
Sunday
yep.
afternoon at Rogers at CNE Stadium, right?
Yep.
A Saturday afternoon, right? Saturday afternoon, Monday afternoon, Labor Day Classic against the Hamilton Tiger Cats, right? How many Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon games are there in the CFL now?
Literally none, because not in Toronto.
Exactly. The television and whatever has come in and has really changed the whole. Like, if you think, boys, football to me is Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, I go down, beautiful fall day, Sunday afternoon, I go to a football game. Well, that doesn't happen anymore.
Well, it's a lot warmer. It's a lot warmer in the afternoon than it is at night in the fall and in the early winter.
that could be another
takeaway. Okay,
exactly.
let's move on to your career with the with the Argonauts. And we mentioned I took my shot at you, probably as bad as Granny Liggins. Mm-hmm. You know, I reminded everyone that yes, Peter Martin wasn't part of winning a Grey Cup, but he can say he was on or at least near the field when Leon McQuay made that dash. What was it like that day, watching that game in person and seeing a moment in time that really would have rewritten the Toronto Argonaut history book?
It was brutal. The whole, when you think back, the whole week wasn't a lot of fun. I mean, we got there Wednesday and it was raining, and we didn't see the sun till the plane went above the clouds Monday morning on the way out of town. So it was abysmal weather all week long. There had been some issues at the previous Grey Cup. There really wasn't a lot of interest in the Grey Cup in Vancouver, so there wasn't the carnival atmosphere and with the weather and stuff like that. So, you know, the whole lead-up to the game and all of that stuff wasn't, what we have now as far as hype and so on. But it was the disappointing thing. I mean, it's like, you know what, it's always when you watch a football game or a hockey game, things that happen in the last 5 minutes are always pinpointed and highlighted as being the critical thing, right? You don't
like
think
the
about
Leafs,
what
like
happened.
Like the Leafs when they fell apart in the last
yeah,
5 minutes?
Yeah,
that type
yeah.
Of thing? Yeah, go ahead.
But it made a singular play like Leon's fumble, right? So, and obviously, we don't know if Ivan McMillan would have made the field goal. We don't know that, right? Even if Leon hangs onto the ball, whether Ivan McMillan makes the field goal. We don't know that, right? Maybe the snap's fumbled and the holder doesn't hold the ball. We don't know that. So, but if you go back and earlier in the game and you look at missed opportunities, there were things that happened in the first half were just as important as Leon McQuay's fumble, right? You know,
absolutely.
Other guys fumbled the ball. We didn't do anything on offense. You know, we couldn't move the football on offense. It's just that Leon's defensively, we played reasonably well. We only gave him one touchdown. We didn't score an offensive touchdown. Do you remember how the touchdown was scored in 71?
No, I don't.
Guy fumbled the punt. The Calgary guy fumbled the punt. Roger Scales, Tony Morrow hit the guy. The ball came out, and Roger Scales, our guard, picked it up and ran it in for a touchdown. We didn't score an offensive touchdown. So, you know, we just didn't play very well. But what you forget, too, right, do you remember what happened after Leon fumbled?
Nope.
We got the ball back. We held them, and then they punted to us, and Harry Aboff kicked the ball out of bounds. You remember that?
Yes, that I remember.
Well, then they got the ball back again because the
exactly.
rule was that if you kicked it, well, still is, if you kick the ball out of bounds, you lose possession. So we would have had the ball around center field, but Harry kicks it out of bounds, and they get. And I think we got the ball back again. I mean, so we had opportunities after Leon fumbled, and we had other opportunities during the game, which we didn't take care of. So it was just unfortunate, you know, that event sort of, you know, gets all the notoriety. But, Frank, I'll tell you, the worst part of that whole thing was the locker room after the game. I mean, you know, you made a comment earlier about winning isn't really the only thing and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, when you're part of a project, like I was part of a, for me, it started in 1965. And if you look at the Argo records in 65, 66, we were awful. When Bob Shaw was there, we were awful. And then Leo came in 67. We got better and better and better. And 71 was the culmination of 7 years of, you know, of my being on the team and working with all of these new guys that came in and putting together a team that was favored to win. And the fact that we didn't, right, was a disappointment. And when you're in the locker room after a game, and it's a Canadian championship, and you walk into the locker room, it's cold, it's damp because it's been raining, it's dark, there wasn't one TV camera in the room, there wasn't one newspaper guy in the room. You really, at that point in time, you really realize that you really are a loser, right? That nobody really cares. Nobody cares, right? And you're sitting there, and there's 36 of us, or 32 of the guys that dressed, we're sitting there. Some guys are crying, and they're kicking and yelling and screaming, and opportunity lost, right? Opportunity lost. But after we came back from that, everybody said, don't worry, boys, don't worry. I mean, you guys, we got the nucleus here, and this next year we're going to be there, right? You remember what happened in 72?
That team stuck.
Worst game of the year? Joe Theismann breaks his ankle, right?
And it was one of the most horrible.
We don't make the playoffs. We don't make the playoffs. I mean, so
that was a horrible break in an ankle too.
It was, but we don't make the playoffs. So I mean, that's the whole thing, that it's the lesson you learn is that, you know, you're right, winning isn't everything, but boy, I tell you what, when you got a chance to grab the ring and you let it slip through your fingers, don't ever think you're going to get a second chance, right? I mean, that could have been the only one, and I mean, I got on with my life, and it, you know, wasn't the end of the world for me. But I tell you what, I'll have to admit that times it'd be kind of nice to look down at my left hand and see it.
Yeah, and wave it back at Granny Liggins.
Exactly. But anyway, it was fun.
All right. So the team was that the best team you played on the Argos? Do you think, or was there another team that was better?
Well, we were pretty good. From 68 on, we were pretty good. But 71, I guess we had a lot of good players. Eh? I mean, when you look at the lineup we had, with Theismann a quarterback, and he was a rookie. I mean, Joe at times played like a rookie too. But we had Cy and Dave Ramey and Stillwagon and Corgill and Ed Harrington, and you know, we had some people, right? We had some players, and we were a pretty good group. Yeah, I think that's the best team that I played on with the Argos.
You know, that the entertainment value for the Argos, and I'm part of Bring Back the Boat logo crew. Mm-hmm. part of members of the Argo Lifers, and basically we've been working towards getting, well, not we, I've jumped in late in the day, but having said that, bring back the boat logo, great logo. The boat logo is a great boat logo, but to me, the definitive for my Argo experience is the white helmet with the blue A. That to me was the Argo emblem to me. That only because, you know, I know the A doesn't say football, but what it does say is when I was a kid and all the attention that the Argos got, that helmet was simple, basic. At the time, it was really a great connection to a team. I had a great connection to it, to the team as a kid.
Frank, do you remember your first Argo game?
Unfortunately, the first game I remember, because my grandmother was a big sports fan, was the Grey Cup. And it was the Grey Cup that involved, oh gosh, I think it was Winnipeg. Is it possible Winnipeg and who else? What's his name that went to coach? He ended up coaching in Minnesota.
Bud Grant.
Bud Grant. He was involved, and because I did watch a little bit of the NFL, and Bud Grant went on to the Minnesota Vikings, wasn't it?
Yep.
The game I watched was the Grey Cup that Bud Grant was in, and I'm trying to remember, was Ottawa in it? Was it Ottawa and Winnipeg?
Was he playing or coaching?
Bud Grant was.
Because he played in the league too.
Oh, did he play as well? Mm-hmm. No, I'm not that old. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm old enough to remember when he played. But it was when he was.
That'd be 60. 62, I think. 60.
Yeah, okay.
No, 65, maybe 65. But I got the Argo fact book out here, right?
Right.
I remember of an Argo game was 1957, and they were playing at Varsity Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Varsity?
Yep.
I sat in the end zone at the Bloor Street end with my feet on the track in the end zone, and C.R. Roberts was the running back. Right? He ran for 100 yards for a touchdown. He ran right straight at me. That's all I saw all night long in 1957 at Varsity Stadium.
But you were younger then, 57? You weren't that young in 57. You were at least a teenager.
17. I was 17.
You're at least a teenager. So that to you is maybe the earliest age that you should have in by your loose definition, I'll say, not a hard definition, but loose definition. The game is more suited to adult.
I don't know. I mean, I'd never been to a game before, and I don't know what it was like to sit in the other stands, because I grew up on a farm in Scarborough, right? Birchmount Road in Lawrence and Scarborough, went to Winston Churchill Collegiate. So my first association with the Argos was listening to it on CFRB with Wes McKnight and those guys doing the games on the radio. And then so when I got to go, my first Argo game was in 57 when I was 17. I started playing football when I was 14, I guess, in grade 9, whatever. That's the first chance I got. I went to go. Then the next game I went to was in 61, I think, something like that, when Tobin Roat was playing. So I didn't get to go to a lot of Argo games. In fact, the first game that I played in 65 might have been the third or fourth Argo game I'd seen in my life. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I didn't get to go to a lot of games for whatever reasons at that time. But so I didn't have a feel for what it was like in the stands. But I sure did when I retired and sat in the seats. Starting in 1973, I sure got a feel for what it was like. It was fun.
There you go.
The old mistake by the lake was great, mate.
Hey, I went. I saw the Guess Who there. I saw the Three Stooges there. Who else did I see there?
You go to the exhibition ground. Did you ever go down and watch the stock car races?
Absolutely, they were the
stock car races.
Yeah, they were hilarious. The guys were
during the CNE they had Jack Kochman's Hell Drivers, right?
Yeah,
and the afternoon show at the CNE, they had Jack Kochman's Hell Drivers on running around the track down at the CNE Stadium.
It was a great place to be. The exhibition was not just Its roots and its reason for its existence was basically, like you said, you grew up on a farm, and that's what, yeah. It was a fair. It was just, we called it here the Canadian National Exhibition.
And you went to the exhibition, right? You went on the flyer.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
Well, terrifying. It was terrifying, wasn't it? First time you went on the flyer. Now you go to Canada's Wonderland, and you got to have a spacesuit to go on the behemoth, right?
Well, listen, don't talk to me about that stuff. I take my kids every 2 years to Florida. We go to Praise Mickey. You know what I'm saying? And now they've learned to like Universal. And they've taken me on those rides where your feet are dangling, you do loop-de-loop. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're right. Well, in the old day, the flyer was a rickety old thing. It go sounded more like a train, you know. It was fun. There were some interesting days. The exhibition, far simpler times, and really the football game was part of all that. That was the
they played during the exhibition.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you bought a football ticket. You got into the X free. Yeah.
And we used to go to the games. You know, football in Canada has gone through so many changes. I'm calling this the year of the stadium for obvious reasons. Yeah, 2013 to me is it'll be marked as the year where the Argonauts are the only team that doesn't have their own stadium that they control. Everybody else does. Hamilton's got their new stadium being built as we speak. They're going to go to Guelph. They're going to suffer through a season of basically not playing at home. But hey, the reward will be next year. They'll have a great home. In the East, you've got Montreal, the leader in getting the appropriate stadium for the game being played and how it's being played today for the purposes of profit and for the enjoyment of the fans in the stadium. You've got Winnipeg now has a bowl that is competitive with anybody. It's a wonderful, wonderful stadium. Mm-hmm. Winnipeg fans are already bragging about it and proud of it. You know, Saskatchewan, not only did they get the Grey Cup this year, they have a new stadium. Edmonton's done some resitting. And then you've got, I don't know, Calgary's either, I don't know what they're doing. They're probably in with, their stadium's not, they're still at McMahon, right? I don't remember anymore.
Oh, yeah. It's a great spot.
But it's always been a great place to watch a game. And BC Place, people talk about it being a wonderful place for football. So, this is the year of the stadium. And I think it's ironic but that's probably why the biggest reason why the subject of where the Argos will play is so discussed because of that. Because everybody else is getting all these stadiums, right? So,
Well, yeah, and keep in mind, too, you got Ottawa's coming in, 2014?
With a new stadium.
And they're going to have a new stadium as well. I mean, if you remember old Lansdowne Park, they have torn down the south stand. I think they've almost torn down the whole thing and completely revamping it. So I haven't seen any architectural drawings or anything like that, but I can imagine it's going to be spectacular.
And you want to know the other ironic thing? It's funny because one of my Box J boyfriends is actually messaging me on Facebook asking me what's going on. And one of the things that he's telling me is Hamilton's is probably going to lose that tailgate thing they got going on with the new stadium.
Is that right?
Yeah, they might lose
I've seen plans of what the stadium is going to look like, and I think it's going to be intimate. I think it's they're going to lose. They're not going to lose the closeness to the field that they had at Ivor Wynne. And to me, it was at one point in time. I think Hamilton was in line to get track and field. And to me, you build a stadium to accommodate track and field. When you convert that to football, it just doesn't work, right? Like you look at Olympic Stadium, it's built for Olympics, and you sit in the front row, at Olympic Stadium, you're miles from the field, right?
So now the
stadium they're building in Hamilton is built for Pan Am soccer, right? So it was very compatible. So I think the compactness is going to be the same, and I think the sight lines will be good. So I think the Hamilton fans will be happy with the intimacy of the place. And apparently what they're doing is they're turning it around. I think on the site now, the stadium, I think, runs east-west, and they're going to turn it around so it runs north-south. Because there's, so you're not going to get the problem of
the sun.
The sun in your face if you're returning punts from
That's
one
right.
end zone. And yeah, so I guess it's going to be really nice. But it's going to be smaller than the current stadium, though. It's going to be smaller.
Well, you just raise the price of the tickets when, you know, yep. supply and demand. You know, that's
yep.
all you do. I mean, people have finally figured that out, that, you know, it's not how many tickets you sell, it's how much they cost.
Well, that's the thing. It's the bottom line is it's what's the average – what's the average price for a ticket, right? The average price for a ticket, and that's what
absolutely.
Makes all the difference. Makes all the difference. So,
absolutely.
Hey, you know what? I tell you what, though, Frank, in the late 60s, boy, you could sit at 55-yard line for $6.
There you go. There you go. There you go.
$6.
Okay. There you go. Okay, listen, can we take another break? This one, I'll make this one a little longer. It'll be about 3.5 minutes, folks. So, Peter, if you need to take care of anything, you want to get yourself a drink, and then we'll come back, and we're off the air in 30 minutes. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay, bud. So we'll take a longer break here, and this is my favorite song, and once again, TSN, and this is my buddy. I'll call him my buddy because I really do know him. Mike Richards, and he's an Argo.
Okay.
I'm just a regular Joe with a regular job. I'm your average white, least I'd like snob. I like porno and Proline and books about porn. I got an average house with nice hardwood floors. My wife, my job, my kids and my car. My feet on my table and a Cuban cigar. But sometimes that just ain't enough to keep a man like me interested. No way. Now I gotta wear double blue and hit the subway downtown. Yeah, 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 yeah. I need football big on a really big field. No silicone cheerleaders. I want my chicks real. I'm an Argo. I fly to D.C. and hide all their weed. I go to Regina and say, how about that wheat? I'm an Argo. I'm an Argo. I park in Commonwealth and take Edmonton spaces while Edmonton people make Edmonton faces. I'm an Argo. I'm an Argo.
Maybe I shouldn't be singing this song, ranting and raving and carrying on. Maybe they're right when they say that I'm wrong.
Nah. I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
I'm an Argo.
Such a
big
Argo.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get myself one of those Condridge Holloway Mets jerseys circa 1982 with the midriff showing, just like those skanky Queen Street Lady Gaga wannabes, and walk right into Harbor 60, and there's nothing nobody can do about it. Yeah! And I'm going to talk about the Argos on the radio anytime I want, because unlike that 60-year-old from The Fan who wears sunglasses on TV, I actually go to the games. Okay! They can take their 20 years of boring people with their Dungeons & Dragons staff and have a great big 20-year-old cakewalk right in the middle of Yonge Street, and it won't make a lick of difference. You know why? Because we got the bombs. Yeah! We got Schultz, Dunnigan, frickin' Naylor, and frickin' Randorf. I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna get Bill Simons, Joel Kroll, Terry Greer, and frickin' Don Moen, and a giant case of Crown Royal, and we're gonna go right down!
Hey, you know what, pal? You really are an Argo.
Just shut up and sing the song, pal.
I'm an Argo!
He's an Argo!
I'm an Argo!
He's an Argo!
Yo, 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 yo.
Hey! R-G-O-O! Oh, oh. Oh, oh!
I'm an Argo, and I'm proud of it.
And he should be. Oh, I got to mention this, folks. I'm now. You can read my stories on GetRealFootball.com. I've become one of the writers on that blog network. They have about, I guess they're saying about 200,000 hits a day, so people read that blog. I hope you enjoyed my first one. Again, Get Real Football, and there are other as well. They have Get Real Hockey and all this kind of stuff. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun to do it, and I had a good time writing the first story. It's basically leading into training camp, and if you follow it, it'll be written, I hope, in a way that if you're not a CFL fan, you'll enjoy learning about the CFL, and I'll try to capture the experience of being a CFL football fan. We're talking to Peter Martin, number 77 of the Toronto Argonauts. We've talked about everything. We've been basically stirring the coal in the fire, and discussing some of the pros and cons of the CFL right now. We both agree that it's a great game. I think we both agree as well that once you learn to appreciate it, it really is, see it in person, it's a lot of fun to be a part of. And maybe one of the things that's lacking in the CFL today, or at least in Toronto, is that camaraderie between the fans, an opportunity to get together before the game and or after the game, which is all part of what is being a football fan historically. I guess that's my segue to Peter Martin. Also did the play. He was the color commentator on the play-by-play on CFRB 1010, and until 2010, he was your Toronto Argonaut color commentator, and he did it for 26 years. You know, played 8 years, I think you said, as a CFL player.
Yep. Yeah, yep.
8 years as a CFL player, 26 years covering the Toronto Argonauts. What a wonderful
career you had. You mentioned my number 77, right?
Right.
You want to hear a story how I got number 77?
Sure.
Remember a player named Ron Brewer?
Yeah, I believe I do.
Played with the Tiger Cats, played with the Argos, right?
Yep.
When my first year, I wore number 70, right? And I got a penalty, And the coach called me in after the first practice after the game, and he said, you know, I looked at the film, and he said, you got that penalty, and I can't figure out why you got the penalty. He said, the only reason I can figure it out is that last year Ron Brewer wore number 70. And he said, I think the referees thought you were Ron Brewer because Ron Brewer used to take a lot of penalties. So he said, from here on in, you're wearing 77. So that's how I got the number.
So, no kidding, no kidding. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a Parkdale kid, wasn't he?
Yep. He's a tough player. He's a good player. Very, very good player. Played with some great ones. You know what? And you know all the old guys, right? And we're talking about the fact that when I made the team in 65, which was, unexpected in a way, and I make the team after, 2 weeks of training camp, and we have four exhibition games, and we had a week between the final cuts and the first game, and in that period of time they made eight changes of players, but anyway, I survived all that, and I on the field I started right linebacker, and I'm in the huddle, and I've got looking, there's Jim Roundtree, right? You remember Jimmy Tree, right? Mm-hmm. It was that cornerback, and Jackie Parker was in the huddle with me, and I just thought, you know what, this is quite something, isn't it, because I'd watched Jackie Parker play for all those years with Edmonton and all that sort of stuff, and here I am standing in the same huddle with him. So that's a memory that stayed with me forever, that one.
You finished 3-3 that season. You guys had a – well, you know, it's like
We were three and eleven or something like that.
I know, but you lost the first seven. Why talk? That was just preliminary stuff. But
another one. We go on that. We talked about these two-game road trips and stuff, eh? We go into Edmonton, and they're brutal too, right? And I think we were 0-6 or something like that, and we played them before. We played in BC the night before, or whatever, day before. We have to go. So Edmonton, they're playing at Old Clark Stadium then, and they had a radio announcer who was living in the press box, right? And he was going to stay and live in the press box until Edmonton won a game. Well, thankfully for him, we rolled into town, and they kicked our butts, and he got to go home and sleep in his own bed for the first time in 3 weeks. So
there you go.
That was game seven, I think. We finally won. I don't know what we did when we won our first game. I'm sure we celebrated somewhere. But that was an unbelievable year. That was an unbelievable year.
I'm looking at the attendance mm-hmm. those days. 28,000, mm-hmm. 27,000, 30,000 at Empire Stadium.
Yeah, 65, though. I don't know when you look at the Argo. We didn't draw very well. And so 65, 66. Because that was really a low point in Argo history at that time, because they had the really good teams in the early 60s.
Okay.
When Tobin wrote, remember they blew that 18-point lead in the Eastern Final, the two-game total point final with Bernie Filoni and the Tiger Cats, and then the team really struggled after that. So when I got there in 65, we were in bad shape, and they brought in Bob Shaw. But I'll give you an idea what it was like to be a player at that time. We got thrown out of every year when the exhibition was on. We got thrown out of we used to practice at Exhibition Stadium, right? We played the games there, of course, and then they had a practice field out by the Dufferin Gates, and that's where we used to practice. But when the exhibition was on, we had to leave. So 65, we went out and practiced at the Dixie Curling Club, right, in Mississauga. Dixie Curling Club, and they had a field out the back that was in bad shape anyway. We were so bad that we'd play and we'd lose, right? They didn't have a practice roster at that time. They had what they call the 15-day list, where you could bring a guy in for 15 days to take a look at him. And they didn't count game days, day before game, game day, game after. So a 15-day trial could last for a while. But anyway, had all these guys. So we'd go lose, right? And so you'd go to practice, the first practice after game, you'd go to practice. There'd be maybe 10, 15 new players, guys that they'd brought in, right? You talk about the airlift.
Mm-hmm.
We'd practice. Thursday night we'd scrimmage. And then based on the scrimmage, the coach would decide who is going to play on Saturday, right? And he'd make his cuts, and then we'd make changes, right? And then we'd play on Saturday. We'd lose. You'd go back to work on Monday. Be another 10 guys there, practice for 4 days, scrimmage, make cuts. And that's what we had to put up with almost all season long. Like, it was the most unbelievable season I've ever went through in my life. Like, you just had, it was just, you talk about going from paycheck to paycheck, right? It was just, it was really incredible. Like, we must have went through 140 players that year. Like, it was just unbelievable, the number of guys that that came through town that year. So that's where the old Argo Airlift. They always used to talk about the Argo Airlift.
Yeah. It lasted
Well, that was Air Canada made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Made a lot of money on the Argos that year. It was unbelievable.
Well, Leo was famous for doing that, Leo's Airlift.
No, not as bad. No. That was the one thing. When Leo came in, I mean, like, he took over a team. We started to show some promise in 66. We won a few more games in 66, and Leo came in. And then, you know, so we started, and he started building the nucleus, and so there wasn't as many changes, you know, as starting in 67, 68, 69, and we had a lot of guys that, you know, just added two or three guys each year until we got to 1971. So there wasn't as many wholesale changes as there was when Bob Shaw was there. So that made it a little easier, but still, you know, like anything else, I mean, you go from one game to the next, right? And unless you're a superstar, you know, you didn't have to worry about it, like a Dick Shadow or somebody like that. But you know, if you're a journeyman guy, like I considered myself kind of a journeyman, sort of a linebacker, I had to work hard every game to try to keep my job. And you know, there was always that, you know, if you had a bad game, you know, you think, oh, geez, do I have a job next week, right? Because all, mm-hmm. you know. There's no guarantees. Like, there's no guaranteed contracts, and there's still no guaranteed contracts in the CFL, right? I mean, you're only as good as the game you play, and then they call you and say, hey, you're out of here, and that's it, right? And so it's stressful, and it's You don't buy a house when you're playing football in the CFL. You never know
no.
when you're going to be no. around to make a paycheck to pay the next mortgage. Right? So
even the guys that make a good living don't want to buy a house because it seems the moment they buy a house, they have to move.
Well, that was the thing. You know, and the one thing that was different back then, too, was they've often sometimes said, too, that a complaint with the CFL is that the rosters change so much, right? The players move around and that. Free agency wasn't a big deal back then, right? Not as like it is now, right? If you wanted to leave a team, you had to play out your option, right? So that meant you'd take a 10% pay cut, right, to play out your option. And there was no guarantees that you were going to get picked up by anybody. Like, I'm not too sure whether the teams got together on this or not, but, you know, there was trades made back and forth, but there wasn't the free agency movement as much as there is now, right? The number of players that change teams every year in the CFL is pretty high. So back then you had guys that stayed with teams a lot longer, like the stars, the established stars, stayed with their teams a lot longer than they do sometimes now when they have a couple of good years and they move on to somebody else. For example, you like a guy like Ricky Foley, right? Ricky Foley plays with BC, right? Then plays out his option, signs with Toronto. Now, where is he now? Saskatchewan now, I guess, is he?
Yep.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That type of thing, so.
Well, you know, it's not that players want to move. It's that the opportunity is there to improve themselves. So, you know,
It's all money. I don't blame the players. I don't blame the players. Your career's short. I mean, I think the average career in the CFL is 3 years or less, right? So you're not there for a long time, average-wise, right? So I squeezed in 8, which is, you know, well above the average, right? And so I'd be fortunate for that. But it's not a long career. And you're one injury away from being finished, right? And so you can't blame the guys for realizing the window is not that big, and you got to grab it while you can. No question about that. So,
well, my only beef with players in any sport, not just
mm-hmm.
You know, like a player signs a contract and expects the team to fulfill the contract obligation,
mm-hmm.
right? And when you get the player that signs a contract then wants to renegotiate, that's the only time I have a thing against players.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I understand
mm-hmm.
that they might have undersold themselves or they didn't have the value mm-hmm. that they, you know, but a deal is a deal in my opinion. You know, that's the only thing I don't like. That's my only negative I can say about players, the ones that say, you know, I want to renegotiate. I understand mm-hmm. that you had it, you know, but they don't renegotiate to drop their contract.
If they negotiate up and stink the joint out, they don't give any money back either.
No, they don't. I'm trying to be fair here, man.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like just you
yeah.
sign a contract, shut up and play the contract out, for goodness
yeah,
sake.
Yeah,
do you have any
yeah,
idea how
yeah.
silly you look? Yeah, you
yeah,
know, and
yeah.
now let's talk about the specifics in the Canadian Football League yesteryear and maybe you know, partway through your history and your knowledge. How has the Canadian content changed in the CFL from when you started playing till as recently as 2010 when you were in there deep covering the game?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now, when I first started, I think we dressed 30 guys, right? 30, maybe 32. I think it was 30. I think we had 32 and 71 for the Grey Cup game. So I think in 65 it might have been 30 players. And we didn't have a practice squad, so you had injured list. If a guy was hurt, you'd be on the injured list, and then they had that what I called, you know, mentioned before, that 15-day trial thing, right? So, you know, the rosters were very small, right? And so, and I think when I first started, I think they had maybe 10, 12 imports, something like that, right? And so what they would do is they would usually take your best Canadian non-import talent and then fit them in and then put the imports around them, right? So, for example, if your best player was a Canadian, he was a quarterback, he'd be your quarterback, right? you know, if your best player was a free safety, he was a Canadian, he'd play, and then you'd put your American somewhere else. So you would find that there were Canadian kids playing then that don't play those positions now, okay? And what's happened is because the roster size has gone up, okay, the American content has gone up, and the only rule is now is that you have to start 7 Canadians, right? Minimum
okay.
7 non-imports. So you take the 24 positions, you have to start 7, okay? Now, you can start 9, 10, 11, 12 if you want to, if you have them, but the minimum is 7. So what has happened now was that sometimes they've allocated positions by nationality. If you look at the teams,
yep.
Most of the teams will have 3, 4. The ideal scenario, they'd like to be have 5 non-imports playing along the offensive line. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so you see the offensive lines are loaded up with non-import talent. And then where do you put your other, you'd have to find 2 more Canadians. So you could be a receiver, could be a linebacker, right? So now you take a look at, you know, the Argo defense, for example, right? Last year they had Ricky Foley, he was a non-import, right? I don't know if there's, Pottinger didn't start than last year, so I don't know if there was any other starting Canadian on defense other than Ricky Foley, right? And then they had 3 or 4 linemen and a couple of receivers, and that was their complement of 7. So in 65, my first year, they would have, I mean, you would have an American guard, right? We had 1, maybe 2 American guards, an American tackle, offensive tackle. Quarterback was an American. Running back, an American. And then on defense, a couple of D linemen, a couple of defensive backs. So, you know, we played my first year, we had 2 Canadian linebackers. We played a 4-3, so we had 2 Canadian linebackers, an American in the middle. You know, we had a couple of Canadian linemen, American linemen, and so on. So there were more Canadian kids on the starting roster back then than there are now, right, because of the ratio. So it's been, as time goes on, the American content has increased. Okay, so now if I got my numbers correctly, they carry 46, active roster 46. They dress 42, right? 3 of them can be quarterbacks, okay? So nationality doesn't matter with that. There's just 3 quarterbacks. And then there's, what's that leaves? That leaves 39. So I think then it's 20 and 19, okay? 20 non-imports and 19 imports. That's the way they distribute their talent now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
With 7 starting, 7 non-imports. Minimum starting, right? So what has happened, unfortunately, is because of that, it has really limited the opportunities for some really good kids who play positions that are predominantly allocated and dominated by Americans. And the hot topic is always quarterback, is it not?
Mm.
Right?
Yep.
How many people say, how come we don't have a Canadian quarterback? Well, you know, Russ Jackson. If Russ Jackson came out of McMaster this year, he wouldn't get a chance to play.
No, he wouldn't.
Right? He wouldn't.
Right.
He wouldn't have gotten a chance to play. Under the current situation, he would not have got a chance to play. But because back in when he came in, what, 61, 62, he was a Canadian, good player, and because of the distribution of talent and all that sort of stuff, he got a chance to play as a Canadian quarterback, and he went on to the greatness that he enjoyed, right? But
because
today,
he was included as a Canadian in the formula,
right.
Where now you don't have to have a quarterback. A quarterback is neutral. It's neutral ratio. Yes. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's just that he got. But the thing was that Russ got a chance to play, right?
Right.
Like right now, I don't think he would even get a chance to play. Like how many Canadian quarterbacks even get drafted, right? The kid from Mac got drafted last year, and he went Quinlan. He went to Montreal. Apparently, he's going back to Montreal. But I think there's only 1 Canadian quarterback on a CFL roster at this point in time, I think. The kid in Calgary, I think if he's still there, he was third string. So, Canadian receivers have a chance, but it's very hard for not too many starting defensive backs that are Canadians. Have you noticed that? There could be a Canadian free safety, okay? Like Logan, he and Logan in Winnipeg, right? There might be, you know, but so it's been restricted. It's become restrictive now for kids that if you're a great big old hog, if you're a lineman, if you're a non-import, a Canadian lineman, your chances are excellent, you know, are excellent to have a long career, right? Like if you are a good Canadian lineman, you can play forever, right? You can play forever because
In sports and in Canadian football in particular, the Edmonton mm-hmm. Eskimos changed how the CFL looked mm-hmm. at the ratio, and the Alouettes now are the new, you know, gauge for how you should have your ratio, and the Alouettes are the type that want to have those five linemen that are Canadian to free up their American content. Otherwise,
see, when I was doing the radio broadcast, I used to take note of that, right? And you'd go into Montreal, and they'd start maybe 10, 11 Canadians, right? Because they were good enough. I mean, they had, you know, they had great good Canadians. And the more Canadians you can play, they see, because you have on the side, you have the guys that start, and then you have the designated imports, okay? Mm-hmm. And that can get complicated too, right? Because you can only have so many Americans on the field at once, so that you, you know, if you're say at your minimum, you only have seven Canadians starting, right? If you take one of your Canadians out, you can't put an American in, right?
Right.
You can put in another Canadian, right? But if you've got 11, if you've got, say, 11 Canadians starting, you've got four guys that you can substitute them for with Americans, right?
Which is a coaching tactic.
It is. And it's, no, but it's a benefit. It becomes beneficial that Canadian content is really important in a way in the CFL, because it allows some flexibility in how you deploy your Americans. And if you can get 10, 11, 12 really good Canadians that can start for you, it's a bonus. It really is a bonus. So, you know, that you want to try to find, you know, the top-notch Canadian kids that are good enough to start, and then that gives you all kinds of flexibility with how you deploy the rest of your American talent, your import talent. So that's just so sort of part of the whole, you know, scouting, recruiting, drafting, you know, trying to get the good kids in the draft, and, you know, trading for good Canadian kids, developing Canadian kids, because, you know, the teams that win, generally speaking, have good Canadian talent, right? You can't win without good Canadian talent. You have to have those kids. You have to have those kids, yeah. Yeah.
Now,
but it's, you know.
No, it's okay. Yeah, finish your thought.
No, it's just that the only thing is, it's become, like I always thought when I, or in 65, it was an open competition, right? That you went to training camp and the best players, every position was open to the best player, excuse me, regardless of denomination or whether your designation, right? You could go in and they say, okay, we're going to bring in this American guy and be your middle linebacker. But you, like I played middle linebacker, right, for a year and a half,
right.
2 years, right, which at that time was unheard of. And it was because of a numbers game and a roster move and all that sort of stuff. But so you went to training camp, and if you went out and played hard and played well, didn't matter what position you were in, if you were the best, you played, and they'd slot the American somewhere else, right? But now I don't think it necessarily works that way now, right? Because they've allocated certain spots to import talent. But
I'd like to switch to some. We got a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to switch to the final topic of the day. We touched upon the fact that beer companies. We've talked off the air about how beer companies were deeply involved in the CFL, and they had the quarterback club where beer companies would sponsor get-togethers with the fans. We talked about other ways fans get together. How has ownership changed? We discussed the fact that one of the changes is that you have one owner that owns two teams. But aside from that, how has the ownership changed in your history that you are aware of?
I think that I'm trying to think. Montreal was always privately owned, right? Ottawa was privately owned. Argo is sort of where, I guess, Bassett owned the team here. So, and Hamilton is sort of was owned. Ralph Cesio was part of the ownership group there. It hasn't changed that much. Winnipeg was, publicly owned, right? Saskatchewan, Calgary was publicly owned then. BC and Edmonton. So the Western clubs were primarily club situations, community owned. I guess community owned would be the word to use. But the East was primarily privately owned, or like they are now. So the change has been, well, Brayley owns BC, right? Calgary's now. It was for Zanny. It's somebody else now. The Flames, I think. Calgary Flames own them now, I think. So Saskatchewan, Edmonton, and Winnipeg are the community-owned clubs at this point in time. You still there?
I'm still here. I turned off my microphone, and sometimes my microphone interferes with the important things that my guests have to say, so I had it off for a second. So ownership hasn't really changed that much.
The one thing that's changed in Toronto, though, right, was that it started off that it was Johnny Bassett owned the team. He bought it, I guess. Bassett bought it from the Argonaut Rowing Club, but the one thing, my impression is that when Bassett owned the team, he had a rather large board of directors, okay? And all of the people that were on the board, if you go back and get the program from 65 and take a look at the names on the board of directors, they were all the who's who of Toronto in the business community, right? And that really gave the team, even though it was owned by John Bassett, kind of a grassroots effect, because he had all these community-involved people involved on the board of directors. The Argos have sort of gotten away from that, right? Bill Hodgson came in, and then he got rid of the board of directors and so on, and you get the private ownerships and all this sort of stuff. So in a way, the club is kind of doesn't have any community ties. Like now they got someone doesn't even live in Toronto owns the team, right? The brewery owned it at one point in time, right?
Absolutely.
European brewery. Well, and then they were bought out by the European company, right, that owned them. Interbrew or something owned the club at one point in time, right? So there's something to be said for community ownership. And I'm not saying that Toronto could go that way and so on, and whether that would be the answer. But you go to Saskatchewan, the people have, they feel, they have an obligation towards the team. If they want the team to stay there, you know, they got to get involved, right? Because if they don't go, the team goes. Simple as that, right? There's nobody to pay the bills, right? If the people don't rally around the team and support the team and have the dinners and raise the money, and they don't have enough money to pay the players, then if they don't do that, the team disappears. Or find somebody who would buy the team in town and pay the bills. There's no way they can say, "Well, I don't go to the game. There's somebody there to write the checks." That doesn't happen out there. So, to me, that's a real bonus. And also, it puts pressure, on the team, because the team says, "Gee, look at these people, what they're doing for us to try to keep this team going, right?" And the fans are supportive of the players. They get involved with the fans and so on, and they get wrapped up in that spirit too. And you know, when things aren't going well, the fans really get on everybody and say, "Look, you better clean up your act here." So there's a lot to be said for community ownership. There is a lot to be said for that. And it sure works it sure seems to work in Winnipeg and Saskatchewan anyway, that's for sure. And Edmonton, one of the most successful clubs in the league financially. Yeah.
It's your team in more ways than one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right, it becomes part of the ownership thing. Even in the NFL, they have that with, of course, the Green Bay Packers that have been constantly.
They're the only
a good
one.
Team.
They're the only one,
and they're and they are the only one. But they've been successful franchise in using that system.
Yeah. Now, can I tell you a quick story about the Green Bay Packers?
Sure.
Ran into a guy, and he, on his bucket list, he wanted to go to see a Packer game, right? So his wife got him through some agency in California somewhere, got him a couple of tickets. He went to a Packers game, right? So when he was in Green Bay, he bought a share in the company, right? They were selling the shares last year for $200, and for $200 you get nothing, right? You get a vote. You can go to the annual meeting, but you can't sell it. It's not worth anything. There's no return on it or anything like that. You're just making a donation to the club. So he buys the share. And the deal is, you have to be in Green Bay to buy the share. Like, you can't write them and send them a check, and you have to be there to do it, according to him. So anyway, he buys his share. So he gets a Christmas card. He gets a Christmas card from them, and so on. And they tell him, and he's also on the list for season tickets. He told me his number was 125,000.
Wow.
That was his number. That was his number. I'm going, are you kidding me? He said, I never get tickets. He said, the number of people on the list is just incredible. Because
you can will
your tickets. That's what you can do. You can will your tickets. So a lot of tickets don't become available, right? Because you can leave your tickets to your kids or anybody you want to. So wouldn't that be nice in Toronto? I have 125,000 people on the season ticket list.
They would take you moving a couple of zeros out of it too. You could drop
you
a couple
that.
Of zeros and still they'd be happy. And I mean, maybe three.
Well, it's going to be. I tell you, this is going to be an interesting year for the Argos, and it's always interesting when you win the Grey Cup, right? They've made a lot of changes on the defensive line and stuff, and there'll be a lot of. And there's usually a certain percentage of roster turnover anyway, whether you win, lose, or draw. But it's a psychological thing too, of having won it, right? Well, we made it, and sort of whether you. It's going to be a real coaching challenge to make sure the guys. Haven't lost the edge and have guys sit back on the oars a little bit. They can't do that. They got to move forward. And I'm sure this coach, the coach they've got now is brilliant. He's a brilliant young coach. And I'm sure he'll make sure that he'll keep the boys on edge. And with all the changes and stuff, I don't think there's anybody's going to feel that they've got it made, that he's prepared to do what he has to do to make sure that the team keeps its edge. And he even admitted we had him at a Argo alumni reunion, and he even said, you know, he didn't think that maybe they were the best team in the East. They were at the end of the year, but overall, he said he didn't think they were the best team. So that there's no reason for them to feel complacent. They still have a lot of work to do. So they'll be it's going to be an interesting year.
They definitely do, Peter. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you and share this time with you. And I hope maybe during the season we can hook up, maybe not for 2 hours, you know, if you're willing all the time. My mic is always ready for you. I have a lot of respect for you as a player and for you as a broadcaster. And I really enjoyed listening to you before you were on the air here today. And all kidding aside, you are one of the Argo greats for more ways than just playing. You've done a lot to enhance the Argo the Argo legacy, if you will. And I love talking to you because you've seen so many of the Argos through history. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Frank. You're welcome. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. I'm more than pleased. I derive a lot of joy out of talking to talking about the CFL and talking to Argos. And it's really hard because it's a tough sell because I'll put it this way. Even the people in the CFL, when I talk to them and tell them what I'm trying to do, they're pessimistic because, you know, it sounds like, yeah, sure, that's what everybody says. But they don't realize that I'm actually serious about it.
Yep.
And that's
the
toughest thing for me, you know, to sell, that I want to help the CFL. I want to be a part of helping the CFL, you know, get the word out.
Well, the thing is, I think you mentioned the number 10 in your opening. They might only sell 10 season tickets. Hey, if you sell 10, that's 10 they didn't have before, right? You start, and you got to work forward, and just keep it up. Keep it up.
Thank you, sir. It's been a real pleasure. And say hi to Wendy for me. You have a real nice wife.
Will do. You take care. Yep.
Thank you,
bye-bye.
Sir. Bye. All right, that was number 77 on your program, Toronto Argonaut. He played in the infamous 1971 Grey Cup where Leon McQuay dropped the ball. And as Peter Martin said, a lot was made of the fact that Leon McQuay dropped the ball, but there were a lot of other things that happened even after that when they could have won the game, and they did not succeed in doing so. It's been a real pleasure, folks. You're watching, of course, listening to Candid Frank Live on Blog Talk Radio. And I hope to hear from you in the near future as well. I'm glad to say that I'm also on GetRealFootball.com. You'll be looking forward to some stories I'll be writing. The one I wrote this week was about training camp, reviewing what happened last year at the end of the year and moving in towards training camp. when I say names like Joe Appel and Jason Pottinger and even Tristan Black, and, you know, when I talk about these people, Mike Bradwell, I've gotten to know them a little bit. I don't know all the Argos, but the ones I've gotten to know have been really thoughtful and considerate people who care about what's going on in the community. And that's something to be said for the league, the players, the teams. And I hope you'll give the CFL a chance. Just go check out a game. Trust me when I say this. It's the best ticket in town. You're not going to get a better deal. And just sit there for a second and then get all excited about the game. Just the game is just so much fun to watch. And ignore the fact that the stadium's half empty. Or, you know, maybe half full. Let's look at it that way. What do you think? Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back again on Wednesday for, of course, our regular crazy
football. The following is a message from the 2012
Wednesday.
Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
Thank you for joining us tonight for the Candid Frank Live Show, heard on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 10:30 to 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio. Have a great night, everyone.